This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Luke Barnes is a postdoctoral researcher at Western Sydney University, where he studies astronomy and cosmology, in simple terms, the universe. With a PhD from the University of Cambridge, he has published papers in the field of galaxy formation and how the universe is fine-tuned for life to exist within it. He is a published author of a book called A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Finely Tuned Cosmos. And he joins us right now. Good morning, Luke.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
That is quite an introduction, Luke. You sound like you study some very, very big things.
Yeah, so I like to joke that anything smaller than a galaxy is completely not of interest to me at all. So it's got to be at least that big.
Wow. So let's talk about your book. You're talking in the book about the finely tuned nature of the universe. Can you explain what you mean by that, finely tuned nature?
Well, so the short story is that we want to know why the universe is the way it is rather than some other way, right? So it seems to be a rather peculiar place. We've got stars and galaxies and people and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And so one of the ways that we can go and, well, let's look at another way the universe could have been is by taking what are known as the fundamental constants. Which is just a set of numbers which tell us things like how heavy are electrons and how fast was the universe expanding at its earliest stages and all those sorts of things. And so the fine tuning of the universe for life is simply the case that when we change those numbers, when we sort of take those cosmic dials and just give them a turn, in our theories, of course, not in reality, we find a universe which is very different to ours. And in most cases, much, much simpler than ours, and usually too simple to make anything complicated like life or even molecules.
Okay, so let's do some like proactive examples. If I took the axis of Earth and I moved it off, what is it, 20-something degrees?
23, yeah.
23 degrees and made it straight, what would happen to Earth?
Well, so the short story is we wouldn't have seasons anymore.
Yeah.
So for part of the year when Australia sort of rotates to face towards the sun, the Earth is sort of laying back and it's pointing right at the sun. That's our summer.
Yep.
Wait 6 months till it's around the other side and we're sort of pointing away from the sun and that's our winter. So if you straightened up the Earth's axis, there wouldn't be... So that's a great example of not so much fine-tuning, but of just a counterfactual, like, what if we change something?
Yeah.
You would have a planet with no seasons. There would be no change in weather with the year.
Right. Okay.
My mind is already blown, by the way. I'm not a huge scientist, but I didn't even know the Earth was at an angle. So there you go.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, I'm learning a lot from you. There's part of your book where it's quite powerful, the conclusion, where you and your co-author, Dr. Lewis, chat about the universe from your different faith perspectives. Mm-hmm. How does your faith speak to the evidence that you see within the universe?
Well, first of all... it leads me to want to go and study the universe. And so one of the interesting things about the book is it's got 8 chapters, and the first 7 chapters, Geraint Lewis, who was my honours supervisor, is now my colleague at the University of Sydney. The first 7 chapters we wrote together just about the science, and so we can do that together. We agree on almost all of the science. There's one footnote you can go and find where we disagree. That's some fun for your viewers later, listeners. And... so the first thing is that, you know, I want to go and study this amazing universe. Beyond that, when I come across the fine tuning of the universe for life, it strikes a lot of people as an odd fact. So it wasn't me, but I've heard of another author who was giving a talk on fine tuning, and someone came up with the audience and said afterwards, you know, I'm not religious, but something weird is going on here. And so that it hits a lot of people as something odd, something weird about it. Like it looks like a put-up job. There's a famous atheist, Fred Hoyle, who said it makes physics look like someone's monkeyed with physics.
Yeah.
So within my perspective as a Christian, I find that I have the resources to understand the fine-tuning of the universe for life. The universe is not just some brute fact that just exists and there's nothing else to say about it at a fundamental level. There is a reason why it's set up the way it's set up. It creates creatures who are, you know, like us. They're moral creatures. They have meaningful lives. They can choose to do good or evil. There's all of that is sort of set up there in the laws.
Mate, I get really excited when I look up at stars. You know, like I like following NASA and seeing, you know, the footage of the cosmos. You know, I'm always fascinated about the different types of stars. But I feel like when you run down that rabbit hole, it gets real complex real quick, okay? So up and down quarks, multi-dimensional strings, supersymmetry and quantum strangeness. Mm-hmm. That all feels real overwhelming. Mate, how do you get your head around what feels like a real profound unknown?
The short answer to that, which might not be very comforting, is mathematics. Yeah.
Right.
The short answer is if we can write down an equation that describes something,
yeah,
then we can get a handle on what its properties are and what it would do in a certain situation. It gives us that level of precision. And when you're a physicist and when you're, you know, you're okay with maths, that's an amazing thing. So you hear people say, oh, look, you know, there's no formula for the stock market or whatever, you know, there's no formula for how people react to this, that, and the other. And what they mean by that is they're so complicated, there's no mathematics. But actually, we found that for the universe, I mean, it could have been like that. There may have been no formula for galaxies or no formula for how our fundamental bits behave. But there are. We can write them down. We can look in the right language of mathematics. They're actually quite you know, reasonably simple and beautiful formulas, if you can speak that language.
There was like a 90s or early noughties TV show that featured a physicist, and he could solve all the world's problems with equations, mathematical equations. This feels a little bit like that.
Well, only at the most fundamental level. So sort of quarks, if you break anything apart, you get atoms, and then you break that apart, you get, you know, protons and neutrons and electrons.
Yeah.
You break protons apart, and the inside there's quarks. So that's the smallest bits we found. That level of stuff is actually the simple stuff. That's the stuff we can write down simple equations for. It's once you start aggregating them together into, you know, microphones and people and all that sort of stuff, that's when things get complicated. So writing down we have equations that we think totally describe quarks. We've got them nailed. But, you know, we struggle to know anything about, like, the stock market or all those sorts of complicated things.
Mm. You spend a lot of time looking at data, looking at the universe. What excites you about when you're studying the universe? What are you hoping to discover, Luke?
So one of the things that pushes a lot of scientists when they sort of, you know, when you're in the pub after a conference or something.
Yeah.
The idea of being the first one to know something is this romantic, wonderful thing. You know, that if you ask for career highlights, there was that moment where they discovered something and they were like literally the first person to know that, and then they got to tell everyone.
Yeah.
That's a real driving thing. And for me in particular, I'm a theorist in particular, so I, you know, equations and computers and all those sorts of things. There is a real satisfaction in understanding why the universe is the way it is, even in some small extent. You know, why we see galaxies that are sort of flat and rotating, these disk galaxies, why that's the case. You know, we have some sort of handle on why that is, why gravity compresses things in certain ways and that. So there's a real one of my favorite quotes from a physicist is a guy called Ed Hines, who said, you know, the reason why we do science is because nature is the biggest jumbo crossword puzzle we've ever seen. And there's just a real satisfaction in understanding the world around us.
I'm trying to think how to word this, because I feel like sometimes when you really geek out on something, you know, and I think as a postdoctoral research fellow, you've really geeked out on something.
Yeah.
Okay. You learn the language, you learn the lingo, and you can become kind of consumed in the world of cosmology and physics and astronomy, right? Mm. And just it becomes an obsession, which is a good, you know, I think can be a really good thing for understanding the universe. Fantastic. But then you got to turn around and talk to Simple Duncan and Simple Sam. You know, and Simple Duncan and Simple Sam don't really get all the big complex terms. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you kind of carry that into a conversation with regular folks? And is there a way that you can kind of unpack that for the regular punter where we can go, oh, yeah, okay, that makes sense now?
So I do a lot of talks to sort of popular audiences. And a lot of astronomers do, especially more than most other scientists, just because there's no astronomy industry, right? There's no practical, there's no direct practical application of what we do. If, you know, we rely on, if, you know, the regular public needs to be curious about what we do and then we're okay.
Yeah.
So I do spend a lot of time talking to audiences and you, you try and see it on their faces, whether they're having a light bulb moment or whether they're totally confused. I did do a talk one once, and it was a new topic, and I could see most of the audience was in it, but there was just one person up the back who just had the most pained look on their face for the whole thing. And the worst thing was they were sitting on the aisle and were leaning out into the aisle, so I really had a perfect, perfect view of this. Looked like just the most... Anyway, that's...
Squinty eyes, furrowed brow.
It looked like someone was putting needles slowly into her... into their arm. Or anyway, yeah. That's the point where you go, okay, I might need to rethink this one. So one of the things that's good is my wife is an English teacher.
Yeah.
And so she comes along. She's my sort of guinea pig when I have a new talk. She was in that one as well. And we debriefed afterwards about what she got and what she didn't. You just have to get good feedback. It's quite a challenge, actually. When we wrote our book and, we're writing another one at the moment, you've got to send it around to people who are not in that world of physics, but are sort of, they can read and they're intelligent and they are interested in these sorts of things to see where they follow along and where they get lost. So you do actually have to work quite hard at it.
I think it kind of speaks to the strength of, for the US, you got NASA, right? So you got guys in fancy jumpsuits shooting rockets into outer space. People can get behind that. You can go to Cape Canaveral and watch a launch. And I think there's... For want of a better word, there's something sexy about the fact you go watch rockets blast off into outer space and famous people and, astronauts drive Corvettes. That was the thing for a long time.
Rock stars.
Yeah, they were. And so does it kind of excite you to know that Australia is about to get its own space program?
Oh, yeah, that's really good. So it is one of the things that gets people into the rest of science, which is why... astronomy and NASA and all those sorts of things are pursued the way they are, is that it gets a lot of people in. You can run popular astronomy nights where you just get a couple of telescopes out in a dark spot and people will come and they'll look and seeing Saturn through a reasonable telescope with your own eyes is really something.
I'm having a whiskey and telescopes night. You want to come along?
That's not bad. It's
cute. Luke, you've studied the universe. What's your favourite thing in it?
Oh, man, huge question. I'm supposed to say my family,
aren't
I?
Oh, that's good.
No, we know you love them, but come on, something you've discovered or seen or you're fascinated by.
So there's, I show this video at every opportunity and people can find it online. So there's a group at University of California, Los Angeles, led by Andrea Ghez, and what they're doing is they have a really super high resolution telescope just staring at the center of our galaxy where we think there's a black hole. Now, being a black hole, it's black, so we can't see that, but what we can watch is the stars in the vicinity, and so they've been doing this since about 1995, and what you see is there's a point in the middle where actually we get a lot of radio waves, so we're pretty sure that's where the black hole is, and every now and then a star will wander close to it and do a complete U-turn in about a month. And so they're obviously sort of swinging around something which is extremely heavy because it doesn't budge an inch when all these stars are buzzing around it, and can make an entire star do a complete U-turn in about a month.
It's got to be an invisible merry-go-round, surely.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a very short list of things it could be. That's one of them. black hole's at the top of our list, but feel free to... To chip in.
I'll write a thesis.
Yeah.
You're allowed to propose it as a theory, right? It's the invisible theme park at the centre of the universe, as proposed by Sam Robinson.
It'll be my application for the space agency in South Australia.
Right. Excellent. Yeah.
That's good. I've always been fascinated. I love it when they do the, here's our sun and here's how it compares to, other suns.
Yeah.
And it just gets bigger and bigger. And then you get to the Betelgeuse. Is it Betelgeuse ones? And then it's red dwarfs and... It's just hard to grapple with the space and the size of the universe.
Mm.
It makes you feel there's a certain insignificance that you have when you look at that.
Mm.
Do you not walk... I mean, you must be one of the humblest guys in the universe. You walk away all day from everything that's bigger than you.
You'd think so. I'm actually at Penrith Observatory. We do these open nights, and it's just, can we understand how big the universe is in our imaginations? And it takes about half an hour to properly try and do this thing, because you can't do it with numbers.
Yeah.
Right? There's no point just showing you some number with 27 digits and going, that's how big the universe is, because, like, we just have no idea of that. You've got to sort of build it up with, okay, imagine this, and then imagine this bigger thing, and then, okay, shrink that one down, and then imagine this big. You've got to do a bunch of steps to try and get your head around how big the universe is. It's especially important when you're a physicist, because... Now, usually if you try to calculate something, you have some kind of intuitive check on it. So for first-year students, we ask them to do this simple calculation, which is basically estimate the volume of your head, assume that it's basically the same density as water, and so work out the mass of your head in kilograms. And every year someone, at least one person, will mess up the change in the units from meters to centimeters or whatever, and they'll write down the answer, my head weighs... 1,000 kilograms, and we just want that person to go, you know, that's wrong. Why don't you go back and just check your answer? Why would you write that down and just leave it there? The problem with the universe is you could write down, like, how heavy is a star, and leave off three zeros, and it's not like you go, ah, that doesn't look right. Like, there's in kilograms, there's 30 digits in that number, 31. You had to get an intuitive feel for the universe takes a lot of effort, because it's so far beyond our usual everyday experience.
But if you took out, so we've got our sun, how far is our sun from Earth?
About 150 million kilometers.
Right. So if we took out our sun and put the biggest star in the universe that we know in that spot, how close is it now to Earth?
Oh, beyond Earth.
So it's literally consumed our...
Our sun in about 5 billion years' time will run out of hydrogen in its core, and it needs to sort of rearrange itself and heat up and expand and contract a bit in order to fire up helium, to burn helium at the center, which is the next biggest element. In doing that, it will grow to be larger than the orbit of Earth.
Ooh.
So we have not alive 5 then. Billion years to get off this planet.
Good luck, Grandson Duncan, eh?
Yeah. 5 billion years. Bit of time to make an action plan.
Yeah, we should be all right.
Yeah. Okay. But still, that's crazy to think that there's a star that big that it would be consuming. Yeah. Like,
so you mentioned Betelgeuse. Betelgeuse is bigger than that. If you know the two constellations people know are the Southern Cross and the Saucepan.
Yeah.
You know the Saucepan? If you think about the Saucepan, think about the base of the Saucepan and just go down from the base, there's a red star there that's sort of a couple of saucepans away. That's Betelgeuse.
Wow.
So you can look for that tonight if you have a sufficiently dark sky.
Right.
And that is, I should look up the numbers, but that is probably bigger than the sun will be. And these are these red giant stars. They're enormous.
Amazing. Well, Luke, we could talk all day about this, but we can't.
No.
We have to wrap it up. Thank you so much for taking the time to come in and talking to us today. Your book is called A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Finely Tuned Cosmos. And, of course, if we do want to get along and hear one of these lectures at Western Sydney, when is it?
So there's a couple of things. The Western Sydney Penrith Observatory does regular... open nights, about sort of two of those a month. So you can come along, you'll see a 3D movie, you'll hear a talk from someone like me, and then there will be telescopes outside for you to go and look at the stars. The other thing that happens out at the observatory is a group that's not associated with the university, but it's called Cross Culture, where we put on talks about basically science and faith. And so the next one coming up is in June. And it's called Einstein's Religion by a physicist called Frank Stutman, just about what the sort of greatest physicist of the 20th century, at least, thought about the big questions of life and all that. So if people look at Cross Culture Penrith, they find that on Facebook, they can get all the details.
Fantastic. Thanks, Luke.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.